DW Africa Link.
A very warm welcome to this edition of Africa Link. It's Thursday, the 6th of September. I am Zipporah Nyambura.
And my name is Abubakar Jallo, and we are coming to you live from our studios in Bonn, Germany.
Coming up, the Kingdom of Eswatini, formerly Swaziland, celebrates 50 years of independence with nearly two-thirds of the population facing serious economic and health issues.
It is an open secret that Swaziland is almost collapsing economically. Some hospitals run out of medication. In some hospitals, if you go there and you get a painkiller, consider yourself lucky.
The relationship between Ethiopia and Eritrea gets even cozy as Ethiopia's Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed oversees the opening of his country's embassy in Asmara.
Now it's time for Ethiopian flag is being waved in Asmara, and this is quite interesting and very important and the first step to do other activities as well.
And India's top court legalizes homosexuality, describing the law as relic of colonialism.
These are just some of the stories we've lined up for you. But first, a look at some of the stories making headlines in Africa and around the world.
DW News.
I'm Shay Meineke with DW News. The United States, France, Germany, and Canada have backed UK findings on the Novichok attack, saying they have full confidence that the suspects involved were officers from Russia's military intelligence service. The nerve agent attack targeted former Russian spy Sergei Skripal and his daughter Yulia. They were hospitalized for weeks. Britain's Security Minister Ben Wallace called on Russian President Vladimir Putin to bear responsibility for the poisoning.
The Russian senior levels of government were involved or were linked to this decision. The government as a whole is obviously led by the President of Russia. Directly or indirectly, he bears very strong responsibility.
The Kremlin rejected the UK accusations and said Russia would not investigate the matter further. In Germany, Chancellor Angela Merkel accused the far-right Alternative for Germany party of using violent protest to stir up ethnic tensions in the country. Merkel said in an interview on Thursday that the AfD party has created a stir over the recent fatal stabbing blamed on migrants in the eastern German city of Chemnitz. Several anti-migrant and counter-demonstrations have broken out across the country since the stabbing, with the latest mass protests occurring in Hamburg late on Wednesday. Some protesters have called on Merkel to step down over her liberal immigration policy that took in around 1 million mostly Muslim asylum seekers in 2015. Elsewhere, Libya said Thursday that it would reopen its only functioning airport in the capital, Tripoli, on Friday. This comes a week after the airport was closed due to fighting among rival groups that killed more than 60 people. More than 150 people were hurt during the week-long clashes. This news comes to you from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. Strong rains have decimated communities in northern Ghana. We go to Maxwell Souk on the ground for more.
Heavy rains continue to hit hard in northern Ghana, with officials telling DW in Tamale on Thursday that hundreds of mud homes have collapsed and several communities have been cut off due to the flooding. This follows the spillage of the Bagri Dam by Burkinabe officials last week. Two people have reportedly died so far, but Abdulrahman Yusuf, regional manager of Ghana Red Cross Society, says that number can't be confirmed.
As at now, a lot of people are displaced. Specifically, I can't give an exact number. And we need to put in place temporary shelter for the displaced people.
Djibouti has welcomed Eritrean Foreign Minister Osman Salah on Thursday, saying the visit marks a new era in relations. It's the latest rapprochement since the two countries signed a peace deal in July that aims to end two decades of Cold War between the Horn of African nations. And finally, India's top court has ruled that consensual intercourse between same-sex adults is no longer a crime in the South Asian country. The court made the landmark ruling on Thursday, saying the law had been used to harass the LGBT community. For more news and information, visit our website at dw.com. I'm Shay Meineke.
In case you just joined us, we're listening to DW's Africa Link program. I am Zipporah Nyambura.
And I am Abubakar Jallo. As usual, we are live on Facebook, DW Africa. Don't forget to share this program if you like it. And let's recognize some of you out there who are listening live now. We have Loveline Benin May, who says hi to you all. Hi back. Salisu, Dana, and Zumi. Thank you all.
Yeah, for sure. Keep it Africa Link. 50 years ago, Africa's last absolute monarchy, Eswatini, formerly known as Swaziland, gained her independence from Britain. In April, King Muswati announced the change of name, which he said would stop the confusion between Swaziland and Switzerland.
But there are many challenges at stake, more than just a name, as they mark their independence. The poor kingdom also faces a number of major economic and health issues. Two-thirds of its 1.4 million people live in poverty, and the life expectancy is just 56, one of the lowest in the world. Crispin Mwakidewi has more.
This year's independence celebration for the Kingdom of Eswatini is crucial in many ways. Not only does it coincide with the birthday of King Mswati III, who turned 50 several months ago, but also 2018 is the year when the kingdom changed its name from Swaziland, marking the end of colonial era. However, most Swazi people feel that there are more pressing issues at hand, such as the poor economic situation and inadequate healthcare. Many still struggle to earn a living. Eswatini's main source of livelihood is sugar export. According to UNICEF, it also has the world's highest HIV/AIDS rate. Opposition activist Lucky Lukele says the situation is dire.
It is an open secret that Swaziland is almost collapsing economically. Some hospitals run out of medication. That includes essential medicines for chronic diseases, diabetes, ARVs for HIV, for TB, you name them. In some hospitals, if you go there and you get a painkiller, consider yourself lucky.
King Mswati, who was crowned in 1986 at only the age of 18, is accused of authoritarian rule. Political parties are banned from taking part in elections, and only candidates approved by chiefs loyal to the king can stand for office. Critics say his decision to change the country's name without consulting anyone did not come as a surprise, as Lukele explains.
Only dictators just wake up and announce a change of a country's name. That's something that requires a consultative process where you involve the citizens at all levels, to the point where you need a referendum. And here the king just wakes up and decides to rename the country.
Mduduzi Gina of the Local Federation of Trade Unions is a strong critic of the government.
Any attempt to change the name of the country either ought to have followed a consultative process, or it ought to have followed a process that seeks to amend the constitution. We do appreciate and understand that indeed that is how our forefathers would refer to our land.
Protesters angered by economic decline have become increasingly vocal in demanding political reform. Whether the king will heed their call is yet to be seen.
Crispin Mwakidewi with that report.
And let me bring in this comment now from Michael Agiemang. He says, this is the sort of independence our great fathers gave to us, and it is better than that the so-called freedom of speech we are experiencing now.
Charles Ameka says the country really needs a political reform. The people must rise up to say no to absolute monarchy, but democracy for social and economic growth.
Indeed. Now let's go to the bigger story that is making headlines in the world.
Of course, that is in India, which has legalized gay sex in a landmark ruling by the country's Supreme Court. The ruling strikes down a 146-year-old colonial-era law known as Section 377, banning gay as an unnatural offence.
The court has now ruled discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation is a fundamental violation of rights. Gay sex had been punishable by up to 10 years in jail, although few people were jailed. Ineke Mills has more.
Ambedkar Zindabad! Ambedkar Zindabad! Ambedkar Zindabad! Members of gay, lesbian, bisexual and transgender groups held tearful celebrations in cities across India as the historic verdict was read out by a 5-judge bench, and many could not hide their excitement.
We were criminals for who we are, but today and anymore from now onwards, we are not criminal. We can live our life as who we are. We are really happy. Thank you, Supreme Court.
People face blackmailing, extortion. There are a lot of harassment cases that people have faced because of this law. And I think like that is not going to happen anymore.
This is going to be a long battle and we'll fight those. But for now, it's like time for celebration.
For decades, gay sex has been considered a taboo by many in socially conservative India. Yashwanda Singh of the Hum Safar Trust, who has been championing for legalisation of gay sex, still believes there is a lot more to be done to change perceptions about homosexuality.
Now, once this has been done, the next is to reach out to stakeholders. Now, interestingly, for changing the mindset of the society, we may need to go to the Ministry of Information and Broadcasting.
India is now one of more than 120 countries to have effectively decriminalized homosexuality worldwide.
Ineke Mules with that report.
Get personal with DW Africa on WhatsApp and don't miss out on any news and videos from us. Go to dw.com/Africa and find out how to join our WhatsApp service.
Get personal indeed, and we are very, very active on that platform, WhatsApp. Now, to the African continent, Ethiopia has today opened its first embassy in 20 years in Asmara, Ethiopia, the capital of its former arch rival.
I talked to Sisai Wubeshet, a journalist who has been covering events in the region. She starts by telling us what the historic opening of the Ethiopian embassy in Asmara means.
It is a very big and exciting news for Ethiopians here in Addis Ababa and, of course, in other regions as well. Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed was on a two-day state visit in Asmara, and he, along with President Isaias Afwerki, opened the Ethiopian embassy in Eritrea after 20 years. And politically, when you see things, the first time Prime Minister Abiy visited Eritrea a few weeks back, they have agreed to open the embassy, and of course they have also agreed on some other points as well. And to make this official and formal, now the office is open. Now it's time for Ethiopia, and Ethiopian flag is being waved in Asmara. And this is quite interesting and very important, and the first milestone, the first step to do other activities as well.
How would you describe the mood at the moment in Addis Ababa after this historic news of the reopening of the embassy in Asmara?
I have talked to some people. They're so impressed and they're very happy. Some of them couldn't even express their feelings right now because there are people who have been separated from their family for more than 10 and 20 years. Now the embassy is open and it's very easy for them to communicate and contact with their family and parents.
Yeah, it seems like a lot of positive news is coming from Ethiopia and Eritrea. What about the contested regions along the border of the two countries?
Well, when we talk about the contested regions, as you know, the Dalambasa people, they went to the other side of the border and they have expressed their happiness, and looks like they are fine with it. And we are looking, we're hearing and looking more positive feelings among the people there too.
That is Sisai Wubeshet, a journalist from Addis Ababa. And of course, Abu, as she says, it's a very historic day. And
It is. And actually, Ethiopians are so surprised about the level of breaking news happening in the country, because this is happening so fast, even for them.
Yeah, I think even Djibouti is very positive. They are praising the move and they're also opening up for relations with Eritrea.
The rest of the Horn of Africa is really, you actually see the trend that, Djibouti is making peace with Somaliland or Somalia and Ethiopia, Eritrea, and they're all trying to have that sort of unity and have business going for them.
Yeah, so our dear listener, you can also contribute and join the debate on DW Africa. You are listening to DW's Africa Link. I am Zipporah Nyambura.
And my name is Abubakar Jalo. As usual, we are live on Facebook. That's DW Africa. And we would like to recognize some of you guys. Jeffrey Kiadi, Tamba, Sada, Rutareka, Alex, you guys are always there. Thank you so much. It's always a pleasure.
And we have a lot coming up in the next 15 minutes. We meet Uganda's best breaking dancing kid. At the age of 12, he knows already what he wants in his future.
When you are dancing, you are like making a story or talking about something.
And xenophobic attacks flare up again in the South African township of Soweto. We meet a Somali man who narrowly escaped being hacked to death. That story coming up a little later. But before that, in Nigeria, the two major political parties have begun selling forms to aspirants wishing to vie for political offices in the February general election. But the cost of the nomination forms in both the ruling APC and the opposition PDP parties are so high that many young Nigerians hoping to contest in the polls have described them as outrageous.
Now, 3 months ago, President Muhammadu Buhari signed into law, Not Too Young to Run, a bill which removed age limit for young people who want to run for public offices. This means the number of young Nigerians seeking nominations have skyrocketed. From Kaduna, our correspondent Zaharadin Umar filed this report.
The announcement of the price of the form came as a big to many young Nigerians who have been hoping to vie for the positions in the upcoming elections under the ticket of the ruling All Progressive Congress APC or the main opposition People's Democratic Party PDP. The APC and PDP are asking political aspirants for the post of State Assembly lawmaker, which is the least position, to pay over €1,500, an amount that can buy a good car and nearly build a decent house in northern Nigeria. This has not gone down well with a 27-year-old who will call Dahiru, not his real name, because he's afraid of retribution in his party APC. Dahiru tells me that he has been running from pillar to post to raise the money to purchase nomination form for a state assembly seat.
Actually, for now, I cannot say I have this money, but inshallah, I know that we can get it.
This, according to some young politician, is outrageous and unacceptable.
Some people that are actually credible, they will not be able to contest. And you have taken my right too, as a voter, to be able to vote for the person I want, because he has not the capacity to buy that form.
It is a blow on the so-called not too young to run bill. A friend of mine is contesting for a governor. He doesn't have that money.
The cost of the nomination forms, which oblige political aspirants to be party flag bearers in the forthcoming February election, has caused uncertainties within and outside the parties, especially the APC. A presidential aspirant under the party has started threatening to leave the party if the cost of the presidential nomination forms was not reduced from the 45 million naira announced by the party. But Lawal Buba, a chieftain of the party in Kaduna State, says there is no cause for alarm.
If you don't have this money, there's nothing wrong. You wait for your time. Nobody is barricading you or stopping you from contesting. I just feel this is a process and it is normal. If you go to other political parties like PDP and others, you still find the same thing.
While the current government in Nigeria is fighting corruption, some analysts are saying high cost of political forms can give way for corrupt practices, because politicians will try to retrieve their money as soon as they assumed political offices.
Zahara Dean with that report. Now, the recent attack of foreigners operating small businesses in Soweto, Johannesburg, has been described by some as a sign that xenophobic violence remains a reality in South Africa, despite government denial. Residents of Soweto last week attacked and looted spaza shops belonging to foreign nationals, largely Somalis, accusing them of selling fake and expired foodstuff.
As Tuso Komalo reports from Johannesburg, experts warn such incidents are likely to increase as the country prepares for elections next year. His report begins with the account of a victim of the Soweto attack.
I was feeling when they were kicking me by the stones on my head. I think there are more than 100 people, so how can I say? And then somebody was throwing me outside there, and then they were kicking me. And we are 4 guys.
This victim of the latest attack on foreigners in Soweto was only identified as Amir. Up to 100 people descended on his shop, beat him to pulp, and looted all his goods. But Abdirizak Ali Osman, Secretary General of the Somali Board of South Africa, refutes accusations that they are selling fake goods.
The whole issue of this fake product is started from a video circulated in the social media. No one from the relative authority has verified it. The messages also that have been running around in social media said that they said foreigners, we don't want them in the townships, so they need to be chased away.
On the other side, the government insists the latest attack are not xenophobic in nature, but just mere contestation over living resources and opportunities. Lebohang Maile, the member of the Executive Council for Economic Development in Gauteng, says the concerns of the communities over fake goods are genuine.
We must get to the bottom of that to understand what are these dubious ways, where are these things being manufactured, and get all the relevant law enforcement agencies to pounce on them.
But Tifulufeli Sintumule, director at the Consortium for Refugees and Migrants in South Africa, disagrees. He accuses the government of failing to admit that xenophobia is at play and it needs to be dealt with.
The utterances that the people were saying down on the ground was that we don't want these people. Who are these people they are referring to? Of course, they were talking about the non-national, that we normally call them foreigners. So it tells you that down on the ground, the people are not welcoming, especially the South African side.
This is supported by Lauren Landau, director at the African Center for Migration and Society at the Witwatersrand in Johannesburg.
What we've seen over and over again is that local groups organize, business associations, political leaders, to attack foreigners, to take things, to distribute to their followers, to help support themselves. And I suspect that's what's been going on as well.
60 people died when countrywide xenophobic violence broke out in South Africa in 2008. Another 6 were killed during a similar breakout in 2015.
To Sokumalo with that report from South Africa.
U-Zone.
And for our segment for you, the young folks out there, let's meet Katungole, pardon me there, who is arguably Uganda's best breakdancing kid. Now, the 12-year-old, he can't stop dancing.
Yes, Abu. And of course, every day after school, he trains his breakdancing skills. What drives him? Julius Mugambwa met him to find out, and his report is now being presented by Eddie Micah Jr.
His hand and feet wiggle in an impressive pattern, followed by a sleek body movement. Uganda's breakdance boy is displaying his talent, cheered on by hundreds of kids who would really love to try what Kato Katungole loves to do, and he's ready to help them.
Be training others and they know dance. Some of them, they say that dance is anything that you do just for fun, but it's not like that. When you are dancing, you are like making a story or talking about something.
If the 12-year-old is not dancing, he picks up the paintbrush. Kato's skill as a paint artist is as raw and vibrant as his breakdancing ones. His painting teacher, Emmanuel Kalule, is his number one fan. Kalalu has linked Kato to professional dance instructors.
This kid had ever seen those people on TV, but didn't know them. He didn't know where they are, and he didn't know what they do.
Kato now attends regular class at the breakdancing class of instructor Abraham Stekia, who said he spotted the youngster's talent right from the onset.
His attention span is amazing for a young kid of his age. But I think the attention span comes from the passion that he has for the art. No one is forcing him to do what he does. He comes here, warms up, stretches, goes into classes, and he learns.
Most of the children in Kato's dance class come from slums around Uganda's capital, Kampala. Kato thinks dancing helps keep them focused on their big dreams.
I wish to become an international hip-hop trainer and dancer, and I want to make my own building. There I teach children, old people, and I make something big, like a big building. I put there children who don't have parents, orphans, those children who dance, who has the talent of dancing, but they don't have where to dance and they are on the streets. Then I bring them together when they dance and they will become like me.
Another of Kato's fan is his mother, who asked the youngster to put up a private show for her every now and then. Sarah Namutebi hopes dancing can provide a better future for her son.
I really wish the very best for my son. I want him to be a star. There are musicians who've made it, and dancers too. I want him to make it great in life.
Kato knows that a career in dancing without education could be impossible, so going to school regularly is much in his schedule as his breakdancing and painting classes. But even at school, he takes time off to entertain his peers. After all, he is still a 12-year-old child that needs to play.
That report was by Julius Mugamboa, presented by Eddie Mica Jr.
And Eddie, at 12, he already knows what he wants to
Indeed,
do.
Indeed, it's fascinating. It's really fascinating.
Did you even know what you wanted to be at 12?
I was kind of similar to him. I was like in a rapping business, you know, that sort of stuff. When we were young those days.
Wow.
What about you? You can't escape this one.
Well, I think I was making up my mind. I was still making up my mind.
Well, I see you managed to escape that one there.
Make your voice count. Join DW Africa on Facebook and comment on the stories there. You could get a mention on Africa Link, which broadcasts live on Facebook. That's DW Africa.
Now to a story we've been covering on social media, that's specifically Facebook. Ethiopia's Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed said China has agreed to restructure some of Ethiopia's loans, including a loan for a $4 billion railway linking its capital, Addis Ababa, to neighboring Djibouti. During our stay, that's a quote from him, he said, we had the opportunity to enact limited restructuring of some of our loans. Anyways, we have a couple of your responses to this particular statement.
Yeah, of course, you know, China-Africa is always a debate and always elicits a lot of reactions.
And the thing is, Africans are so mixed when it comes to China. A lot of people support Chinese presence in Africa and a lot of people are against it.
And that is obvious by the response we got. For example, Maxim Otu says Chinese loans to Africa is a subtle form of colonization. Unfortunately, our leaders are too blind to the dangers of these loans.
And Kaspar Mbindi from Botswana says China is as business as a bee. Anyway, a debt is a debt regardless of how you restructure it, and the longer the payment period, the more the interest.
Wow, that is quite...
That really describes exactly what's going on, right?
Yeah, and Blasius, our song says, this man is happy that his country is going to be beholden to China for the next 30 years. He says, if I were him, I don't think I would have let anyone know that I just mortgaged the future of my country to the Chinese.
And Mike Okori says, it's no good news. It means Ethiopia will have to pay interest for 30 years. But actually, you can criticize China. You really can. But you can also say, thanks to China, Africa's economy has never grown this fast. You can actually see Ethiopia, all the other countries. I mean, there's also good things to talk about here,
yeah,
don't you think?
Good things and bad things. And Abu, if you know now, there's also a debate on China in Africa because of one man who actually said some racial comments about Kenyans.
And who is that man?
He's a Chinese. He's who is working in Kenya. And of course, it's a debate which has also elicited reactions, and people are questioning whether Chinese really respect Africans when they come to work.
But you have to understand that we look at, you know, Chinese presence in Africa with, you know, with all those Western human rights values and stuff. I mean, this is not something that is such a big deal in China, you know. So, I mean, I'm not defending China here, but I'm also saying that you have to look at it from the other end.
Yeah, and what about you, our listeners? Of course, you have the final say. You can also join the debate on our Facebook page, DW Africa, and we will be happy to read your comments when we can.
Definitely, definitely. Keep the conversation going there. It's been a pleasure. My name is Abubakar Jalo.
And I'm Zipora Nyambura. Bye for now.
DW. Made for Minds.